Yeah, it's time to get our view from the middle. He was back in town at his old stomping ground for Saturday's Austin Massacre. Headed up Rocky Top for Bama, Tennessee. Find his work for USA Today online, usatoday.com. Follow on his Twitter account. Use the handle at George Schroeder. Mr. Schroeder, how are you today, sir?
Man, I'm good. How are you?
All right. You know, I ask you things like this all the time. It's part of living vicariously. But you head for Neyland Stadium. It's 95 years old, just a huge venue, SEC country, the checkerboard end zone, Smokey, The Rock. How cool is it to not only watch a game there, but kind of drink in the whole college football experience?
Oh, it's really cool. I mean, you know, it's one of those places that you know, should be on everybody's bucket list. And, you know, I'm thankful that I get a chance and have gotten a chance over the years to check a lot of those off and go back several times. So, you know, I know a lot of Oregon fans went in 2010.
Yep.
And not only experienced sort of Neyland Stadium, but got to experience, you know, one of the worst weather evenings of all time, probably. The rain was going sideways and swirling at the same time. But, it's a fantastic place for college football. It's one of those places that you want to go, and then you want to spend time on a Saturday there, you know, just with everything around the game itself, too. And that's where you ever recognize that, you know, a fierce rivalry, even though it's been pretty one-sided recently, in Tennessee-Bama is about to unfold, too.
Now, Tennessee did it again with a twist. They're down 14, under 4 minutes to go. They knock the ball out of the hand of the A&M guy running for the end zone. But then they go to overtime and lose. The odds makers have Bama a pretty strong favorite, 13, 14 points. You've seen these teams. You give UT what kind of chance? And safe to say, they better not stumble and fall behind in this one.
Well, I agree with that. I give them, you know, every chance. I picked Alabama in our staff picks. I mean, you know, when you start picking against Alabama, that's when you're going to start losing ground in your staff picks. That's why you don't pick against them. But look, Tennessee has played Alabama really tough over the last few years, even in losses. I mean, there have been two or three games that went down to the wire. Last year's game could have gone the other way. You know, and that goes back several different coaches. It's a rivalry game. Those were games, by the way, that went down to the wire when Alabama was about what Alabama is now, but Tennessee wasn't what Tennessee appears to have grown into now. So, you know, I get that the line opened at 8, somewhere around 8, and it's up to 13. And, you know, I don't pretend to be knowledgeable about why people bet or those kinds of things. I get this, though. I mean, people think Alabama's really, really good. I do, too. I also think that they're in the middle of a brutal stretch and that they may take a loss. You know, they didn't against Arkansas, but they've got Tennessee this week, and then they go home to play Texas A&M next week, and it wouldn't stun me if they lost one of those two games. So, you know, you're right, Tennessee cannot afford to start slow. But Alabama hasn't been the fastest starting team itself.
Yeah, I actually kind of forgot when you mentioned Alabama won that game last year, like, in the last 3 minutes.
Right.
Yeah, let's stick in the SEC. Obviously, Hurricane Matthew, and they had to cancel LSU in Florida. Early on, somebody says it's canceled. Some said postponed. Commissioner Sankey said they got to play it. We're about to hit mid-October. You wrote about this. I mean, as crazy as it sounds, the SEC title game is 7 weeks from Saturday. What are they looking at? What are the options and maybe barriers?
Well, I mean, they've got a couple options. October 29th is a possibility. Georgia and Florida would need to move their game up a week. I don't think that's likely to happen. LSU, I think, has an open week at that point, and so they could do that. But Georgia has indicated they don't want to do that, and that's a problematic thing because that game is a neutral site game, Georgia-Florida. It's at Jacksonville. The stadium is an NFL stadium that's configured differently for the Jaguars than it is for that rivalry game. And while Jacksonville, the Jaguars don't have a game on, I guess, the 30th, the day after the currently scheduled game, they've got a game on the 23rd. And so you couldn't, you know, remake the stadium configuration. I don't know exactly what that means, but the seating configuration is different.
Sure.
And so logistically, that'd be troublesome. The most likely date is November 19th when both Florida and LSU play non-conference games. And, you know, will that happen? I think that's when it's going to happen. It's probably not going to be December 3rd pushing the SEC championship back a week, because that pushes all of college football back a week in terms of the playoff selection and stuff like that. They're not going to be able to do that. So it's either going to be the 19th or it may not get played. And I do think it's going to get played. And I actually think that the bluster and hyperbole out of Louisiana, which has been coming from the LSU athletic department and filtered through media and into fans, has been misplaced and, you know, frankly, pretty goofy. And Joe Oliva, I think, is really probably just trying to find a way. I think this, you know, if you want to look for sort of an underlying reason, I think Joe Oliva's concerned about his job and sees this as an issue that he can sort of stand and pound the pulpit on a little bit. But the idea that Florida, you know, had underhanded reasons, you know, whether they were afraid of LSU or whatever else, for not wanting to play the game, is goofy in itself. And then the idea that LSU won't, you know, be accommodating on this is goofy too. So I think it's going to end up playing on November 19th. I think we ought to know here in the next day or two. But who knows? Who knows what will happen? And it's a significant test because of the way the two schools have sort of arrayed themselves publicly. For Greg Sankey, the new commissioner, he's not new, but, you know, 15 months into his tenure, it's sort of the first public spat to come out. And I will say the other thing, too, is interesting, is the SEC likes to portray itself as sort of this one big happy family thing, where the Big 12, for example, has all this sort of public dysfunction playing out. And what you see here is there's dysfunction in all of these leagues. It's just that the SEC and a couple of the other leagues have done a better job of tamping it down over the years than, say, the Big 12 has. But, you know, we've seen some of it spill out the Pac-12. We saw it spill out over the, you know, what Larry Scott said about Dan Guerrero and his handling of a vote for the league
right.
in an NCAA council meeting. We've seen some of that spill out with other athletic directors in the Pac-12. But you don't see it very often in the SEC. What you see, though, is they're not one big happy family any more than anybody else is.
Yeah, that SEC chant a little dimmed here as we continue with George Schroeder, USA Today. I'm kind of a Navy midshipman geek. I think it might have been partly because my dad was such a big Army fan, and I always like to poke fun at him. But man, they beat Houston, a team with playoff aspirations. I love the Barry Switzer quote that you had. Wishbone's not dead, just all the coaches who use it, except for Ken Niumatalolo. Is that the correct way to say his name?
Yeah, I don't know.
All right.
I have to re-spell it. I have to double-check the spelling every time. I'm not even close to pronouncing it.
Yeah, it's very phonetically involved. Why, you know, they actually, in a lot of ways, feel they have to run that offense. And how the heck does it succeed?
I think it succeeds in part now because nobody can prepare for it because they don't ever see it. You know, I think that's part of it. And so it's an equalizer for these service academies, the ones where we see it the most, obviously. It's an equalizer for schools that aren't able to recruit the same level of athlete. Obviously, service academies are typically smaller and lighter. And smaller doesn't always mean faster either. So it works for that reason. But what was interesting to me was Barry Switzer says, look, if I were coaching today, and he's in his 70s now, so he's not coming back to coaching today. He said, I would run the wishbone out of the spread. And he means the wishbone, you know, with the three backs and the quarterback.
Wow.
You know, the fullback, the two halfbacks, and the quarterback. But he'd run it out of the spread. And he said it would be as devastating with big-time players as it was when the Oklahomas of the world were running it with big-time players, you know, back in the day when he was coaching. And, you know, I don't know if that's true or not, but, it, you know, it would add something to it if you sort of added splits for the spread and you had, you know, receivers spread further out and, you know, maybe you didn't utilize a tight end as often. I mean, I could see that he's got a point there. You know, elements of the option game are a big piece of the spread in the way it's evolved over the last few years with the zone read. And, you know, a lot, there are schools now, if you have a couple of good running backs, you're using them both as split backs and running option stuff off of that, too. And what you don't usually have is the fullback. But I thought it was really interesting that Barry Switzer was just adamant. And it all came from a tweet that he tossed out there on Saturday night. you know, in relation to the Navy upset of Houston, where he sort of basically said, hey, all the coaches that coached it are dead, but the wishbone would be really good if somebody wanted to coach it, if wanted to play it.
No, I thought it was fascinating. Of course, it would be easier if you had Jameel Holloway running it like he did in 85.
So, yeah, that makes it easier. But no, but listen, think about putting Marcus Mariota in the wishbone. It's, you know, look, you want Marcus Mariota throwing the ball, but a guy who's an athlete like that, right?
Right.
In the wishbone with good running backs and fast skill guys like Oregon's had in a spread. That's sort of what Barry Switzer's envisioning. Or think about JT Barrett running the wishbone with the Ohio State talent.
Wow.
That's what he's envisioning. Now, they're running some semblance of an option game an awful lot. These schools are both, you know, Oregon is and Ohio State is and all sorts of teams are. But, you know, I just think that guy was a pretty good offensive mind in terms of the wishbone. I bet he could do some things with it, running the bone out of the spread. You know, who knows? We'll see.
No,
I don't know anybody who'll try it.
It was just fascinating because what it made me do is go back and see what it took to run it then and how you'd get like 7-8 guys a year who'd have 50-60 carries and they just came at you in waves. It was fascinating.
Well, and the thing is he was explaining to me on the phone, I didn't get it to him in the piece, was it's a quarterback deal too. The halfbacks get the ball when the defense makes you give them
sure.
the ball. So if you've got a quarterback who's a big time athlete, and that's where the Navy quarterback who follows, it's the guy after Keenan Reynolds, who was their big-time player last year. But the Navy quarterback, I can't remember his name, Will Worth, I think, you know, had accounted for a ton of rushing yards because Houston was taking the pitch men. And so the quarterback, if he's a good athlete, can make a lot of hay. It's just that, anyway, you don't want to treat us on the wishbone, so I'll stop.
Why not? I thought the thing was absolutely fascinating. All right.
It might be better for you and me the next time I'm in town, and we'll just go eat lunch and talk about it.
Okay. Maybe I'm just trying to avoid asking you about what happened on Saturday.
Yeah, that's what crossed my mind. That's what you were up to.
I mean, that was just a devastating loss. I think you can make a case it's one of the worst performances in program history. We all have a vision of how games that we're going to watch will go. I mean, Washington took out like a dozen years of frustration in four quarters. What surprised you? The lopsided nature, how fast Oregon has fallen? I mean, you're watching that game. What are your primary observations?
Well, probably both of the things you just said. The lopsided nature, I mean, first of all, I'm like a lot of other people, even Duck fans, if they're being honest with themselves, I don't think they really expected Oregon to win because they'd seen what Oregon had been playing like and what Washington had been playing like. But I didn't expect, and I don't know anyone who did, somebody to hang 70 on Oregon. And 70, you know, sometimes games hurt more than actually just the loss itself. And when it's 70-21, that's one of those type of games. And that's not even, it's not even the fact that it was your big rival that you'd been dominating for a dozen years. I mean, that's just one game. Oregon could go back and win next year. But it's 70-21, and it felt like it was a, wow, exactly what you said. Look how far this program has fallen while this other one is rising in a hurry. Now, how high did the Huskies go? I don't know. But, you know, that's not necessarily Oregon's problem. Oregon's problem is how far have they fallen and is there further to go and how do they get back up?
Now,
and so that was really the takeaway was like, oh, my, it's amazing how far it's gone. It was the first time I've seen them in person, I think, since the national title game.
2014, right.
Yeah, and you know, it's a different looking bunch.
Now, I talked with a lot of the Husky guys, Adam Jude, some of the reporters. I've watched them probably four full games, and I don't see a weakness on either side of the ball, any unit. Browning, his improvement from last year is remarkable. Their defense is tenacious. They get the quarterback without blitzing. I mean, you've seen a lot of teams this year. How legit you think it is that they could run out and be knocking on the door to make the playoff?
Well, I think I haven't seen a whole lot of the Pac-12, but what I've seen of the Pac-12 would indicate that Washington looks like the best team in the Pac-12. Now, running the table is a hard thing to do. And if they go 12-1, then there's, because of the bad non-conference schedule they had, it's going to be an interesting, comparison between them and some of the other Power 5 champions potentially. But given or even a Power Five non-champion. You know, if the right team were to go something in one, and you know, a Louisville, for example, and look really good doing it. But I do think they look like you described. I think I would describe them as complete. They don't look to me quite like Ohio State and Alabama, two teams I've seen in person this year. But they are trending that direction when you kind of look at them. They've got that. They've got a little bit of that feel going on the roster in terms of size and speed and that kind of stuff. And you know, they look like they're a really good team that's getting better and better. And frankly, the non-conference schedule like that is not a bad thing for a team in this position, which is sort of making its first run, because it sort of allowed them to sort of ease into everything. And then by the time they got to conference play, they were clicking on all cylinders. I agree with you on Jake Browning too, by the way. Second year, you know, as the starter, and he looks like he's mastered every piece of Chris Peterson's offensive system. They're still running a whole lot of what we got very familiar watching at Boise. They're just doing it with a lot better athletes.
Sure. One final thought, maybe a positive note. You look at Justin Herbert, and sometimes with a true freshman, they step on a basketball court, they step on a football field, and you're like, not yet. I think at least he looked like he belonged, maybe a glimpse of what he could grow into. What'd you think about the young guy from Sheldon?
Yeah, I thought he provided a spark, which is good. I think the unfortunate thing is that he's going, because of how bad the defense has been, and unless there's some radical improvement, and I don't know why we would suddenly expect that, the offense is going to be called on to win a lot of shootouts. And look, that might be as good of a defense as Oregon will see this year. So that's good news. But you know, the offense was still kind of hit or miss, and so that's a lot of pressure on a young guy like that to sort of win shootouts and be the hero every week. And so, you know, I think he showed some good glimpses that might serve him well for the future. I don't know how that translates down the last, you know, half of the second half of the season. How does that work out? I don't think we know that yet. I think that's still to be determined, and maybe it'll go great. But he definitely looked like a bit of a find for Oregon, I guess would be the way I put it.
All right, I'm going to file it under TBD. You enjoy your trip to Rocky Top. Catch everything he does, usatoday.com, at George Schroeder on Twitter. By the way, the quarterback for Navy was Will Wirth. I checked that while we were talking. So you travel safe. Always my pleasure, and look forward to talking to you again next week, George.
All right, hey, thanks, Steve.
All right, take it easy.